On the third afternoon, before we were to be banqueted to celebrate our safe return, I bet you were really in a mood to party, too, Eddie said. Roland smiled, without humor, still studying his hands. At around 4 o'clock, Cuthbert and Alain came to my rooms. We were a trio for an artist to paint, I wot, wind-burned, hollow-eyed, hands covered with healing cuts and scrapes from our climb up the side of the canyon, scrawny as scarecrows. Even Alain, who tended toward stoutness, all but disappeared when he turned sideways. They confronted me, I suppose you'd say. They'd kept the secret of the ball to that point, out of respect for me and for the loss I'd suffered, they told me, and I believed them. But they would keep it no longer than that night's meal. If I wouldn't give it up voluntarily, it would be a question for our fathers to decide. They were horribly embarrassed, especially Cuthbert, but they were determined. I told them I'd give it over to my own father before the banquet, before my mother arrived by coach from Debaria, even. They should come early and see that I kept my promise. Cuthbert started to hem and haw and say that wouldn't be necessary. But of course it was necessary. Yeah, Eddie said. He had the look of a man who understood this part of the story perfectly. You can go into the crapper on your own, but it's a lot easier to actually flush all the bad shit down the toilet if you have somebody with you. Alain at least knew it would be better for me, easier, if I didn't have to hand the ball over alone. He hushed Cuthbert up and said they'd be there. And they were. And I gave it over, little as I wanted to. My father went as pale as paper when he looked into the bag and saw what was there, then excused himself and took it away. When he came back, he picked up his glass of wine and went on talking to us of our adventures in Magus as if nothing had happened. But between the time your friends talked to you about it and the time you gave it up, you looked into it, Jake said. Went into it. Traveled in it. What did it show you that time? First, the tower again, Roland said. And the beginning of the way there. I saw the fall of Gilead and the triumph of the good man. We'd put those things back a mere 20 months or so by destroying the tankers and the oil patch. I could do nothing about that, but it showed me something I could do. There was a certain knife. The blade had been treated with an especially potent poison, something from a distant mid-world kingdom called Garlan. Stuff so strong even the tiniest cut would cause almost instant death. A wandering singer, in truth John Farson's eldest nephew, had brought this knife to court. The man he gave it to was the castle's chief of domestic staff. This man was to pass the knife on to the actual assassin. My father was not meant to see the sun come up on the morning after the banquet. He smiled at them grimly. Because of what I saw in the wizard's glass, the knife never reached the hand that would have used it, and there was a new chief of domestics by the end of that week. These are pretty tales, I tell you, are they not? Aye, very pretty indeed.
Did you see the person the knife was meant for? Susanna asked. The actual killer?
Yes.
Anything else? Did you see anything else? Jake asked.
The plan to murder Roland's father didn't seem to hold much interest for him. Yes, Roland looked puzzled. Shoes. Just for a minute. Shoes tumbling through the air. At first I thought they were autumn leaves. And when I saw what they really were, they were gone, and I was lying on my bed with the ball hugged in my arms, pretty much the way I carried it back from Magus. My father, as I've said, his surprise when he looked inside the bag was very great indeed.
You told him who had the knife with the special poison on it, Susanna thought. Jeeves the butler, or whoever, but you didn't tell him who was supposed to actually use it, did you, sugar? Why not? Because you wanted to take care of that little spot of work your own self?
But before she could ask, Eddie was asking a question of his own. Shoes? Flying through the air? Does that mean anything to you now? Roland shook his head.
Tell us about the rest of what you saw in it, Susanna said.
He gave her a look of such terrible pain that what Susanna had only suspected immediately solidified to fact in her mind. She looked away from him and groped for Eddie's hand.
I cry your pardon, Susanna, but I cannot. Not now. For now I've told all I can.
All right, Eddie said. All right, Roland, that's cool.
Well, I agreed.
Did you ever see the witch again?
Jake asked.
For a long time it seemed Roland would not answer this either, but in the end he did.
Yes, she wasn't done with me. Like my dreams of Susan, she followed me. All the way from Mages, she followed me.
What do you mean? Jake asked in a low, awed voice. Cripes, Roland, what do you mean?
Not now. He got up. It's time we were on our way again. He nodded to the building which floated ahead of them. The sun was just now clearing its battlements. Yon glitter dome's a good distance away, but I think we can reach it this afternoon if we move brisk. 'Twould be best. It's not a place I'd reach after nightfall, if that can be avoided.
"'Do you know what it is yet?' Susanna asked.
"'Trouble,' he repeated. "'And in our road.'
4. For a while that morning, the Finny warbled so loudly that not even the bullets in their ears would entirely stop up the sound. At its worst, Susanna felt as if the bridge of her nose would simply disintegrate, and when she looked at Jake, she saw he was weeping copiously, not crying the way people do when they're sad, but the way they do when their sinuses are in total revolt. She couldn't get the saw player the kid had mentioned out of her mind. "Sounds Hawaiian," she thought over and over again, as Eddie pushed her grimly along in the new wheelchair, weaving in and out of the stalled vehicles. "Sounds Hawaiian, doesn't it? Sounds fucking Hawaiian, doesn't it, Miss Oh-So-Black-and-Pretty?" On both sides of the turnpike, the Finny lapped all the way up to the embankment, casting its twitching, misshapen reflections of trees and grain elevators, seeming to watch the pilgrims pass as hungry animals in a zoo might watch plump children. Susanna would find herself thinking of the Finny in Eyebolt Canyon, reaching out hungrily through the smoke for Latigo's milling men, pulling them in and some going in on their own, walking like zombies in a horror movie, and then she would find herself thinking of the guy in Central Park again, the wacko with the saw.
"Sounds Hawaiian, doesn't it? Counting one Finny, and it sounds Hawaiian, doesn't it?"
Just when she thought she could stand it not a moment longer, the Finny began to draw back from I-70 again, and its humming warble at last began to fade. Susanna was eventually able to pull the bullets out of her ears. She tucked them into the side pocket of her chair with a hand that shook slightly.
"That was a bad one," Eddie said.
His voice sounded clogged and weepy. She looked around at him and saw his cheeks were wet, his eyes red.
"Take it easy, Susie boy," he said. "It's my sinuses, that's all. That sound kills them."
"Me too," Susanna said. "My sinuses are okay, but my headaches," Jake said. "Roland, do you have any more aspirin?"
Roland stopped, rummaged, and found the bottle.
"Did you ever see Clay Reynolds again?"
Jake asked, after swallowing the pills with water from the skin he carried.
"No, but I know what happened to him. He got a bunch together, some of them deserters from Farson's army, went to robbing banks. In toward our part of the world, this was, but by then bank thieves and stage robbers didn't have much to fear from gunslingers."
"The gunslingers were busy with Farson," Eddie said.
"Yes. But Reynolds and his men were trapped by a smart sheriff who turned the main street of a town called Oakley into a killing zone. 6 of the 10 in the gang were killed outright. The rest were hung. Reynolds was one of those. This was less than a year later, during the time of Wide Earth." He paused, then said, "One of those shot dead in the killing zone was Coral Thorin. She had become Reynolds' woman, rode and killed with the rest of them." They went on in silence for a bit. In the distance, the Finny warbled its endless song. Jake suddenly ran ahead to a parked camper. A note had been left under the wiper blade on the driver's side. By standing on his toes, he was just able to reach it. He scanned it, frowning.
"What does it say?" Eddie asked.
Jake handed it over. Eddie looked, then passed it to Susanna, who read it in turn and gave it to Roland. He looked, then shook his head. I can make out only a few words. Old woman, dark man. What does the rest say? Read it to me.
Jake took it back. The old woman from the dreams is in Nebraska. Her name is Abigail.
He paused.
Then down here it says, the dark man is in the west, maybe Vegas.
Jake looked up at the gunslinger, the note fluttering in his hand, his face puzzled and uneasy. But Roland was looking toward the palace which shimmered across the highway, the palace that was not in the west but in the east, the palace that was light, not dark.
In the west, Roland said. Dark man, dark tower, and always in the west.
Nebraska's west of here, too, Susanna said hesitantly. I don't know if that matters, this Abigail person, but...
I think she's part of another story, Roland said.
But a story close to this one, Eddie put in. Next door, maybe. Close enough to swap sugar for salt, or start arguments.
I'm sure you're right, Roland said. And we may have business with the old woman and the dark man yet, but today our business is east. Come on. They began walking again.
5. What about Shimi? Jake asked after a while.
Roland laughed, partly in surprise at the question, partly in pleased remembrance. He followed us. It couldn't have been easy for him, and it must have been damn scary in places. There were wheels and wheels of wild country between Magus and Gilead, and plenty of wild folks, too. Worse than just folks, mayhap. But Ka was with him, and he showed up in time for year's end fair. He and that damned mule.
Cappy, Jake said.
Appy, Oi repeated, padding along at Jake's heel.
When we went in search of the tower, I and my friends... Shimi was with us as a sort of squire, I suppose you'd say.
But Roland trailed off, biting at his lip, and of that he would say no more.
Cordelia? Susanna asked. The crazy aunt?
Dead before the bonfire had burned down to embers. It might have been a heart storm or a brainstorm, what Eddie calls a stroke.
Perhaps it was shame, Susanna said, or horror at what she'd done.
It may have been, Roland said. Waking to the truth when it's too late is a terrible thing. I know that very well.
Something up there, Jake said, pointing at a long stretch of road from which the cars had been cleared. Do you see?
Roland did. With his eyes he seemed to see everything. But it was another 15 minutes or so before Susanna began to pick up the small black specks ahead in the road. She was quite sure she knew what they were, although what she thought was less vision than intuition. 10 minutes after that, she was sure. They were shoes. 6 pairs of shoes, placed neatly in a line across the eastbound lanes of Interstate 70.
Chapter 2. Shoes in the Road.
1. They reached the shoes at mid-morning. Beyond them, clearer now, stood the glass palace. It glimmered a delicate green shade, like the reflection of a lily pad in still water. There were shining gates in front of it. Red pennons snapped from its towers in a light breeze. The shoes were also red. Susanna's impression that there were 6 pairs was understandable, but wrong. There were actually 4 pairs and 1 quartet. This latter, 4 dark red booties made of supple leather, was undoubtedly meant for the 4-footed member of their quartet. Roland picked one of them up and felt inside it. He didn't know how many bumblers had worn shoes in the history of the world, but he was willing to guess that none had ever been gifted with a set of silk-lined leather booties.
"Bally, Gucci, eat your heart out," Eddie said. "This is great stuff."
Susanna's were easiest to pick out, and not just because of the feminine, sparkly swoops on the sides. They weren't really shoes at all. They had been made to fit over the stumps of her legs, which ended just above the knees.
"Now look at this," she marveled.
holding one up so the sun could flash on the rhinestones with which her shoes were decorated, if they were rhinestones. She had a crazy notion that maybe they were diamond chips.
Cappies. After 4 years of getting along with my friend Cynthia called circumstances of reduced leg room, I finally got myself a pair of cappies. Think of that.
Cappies, Eddie mused. Is that what they call them?
That's what they call them, sugar.
Jake's were bright red Oxfords. Except for the color, they would have looked perfectly at home in the well-bred classrooms of the Piper School. He flexed one, then turned it over. The sole was bright and unmarked. There was no manufacturer's stamp, nor had he really expected one. His father had maybe a dozen pairs of fine handmade shoes. Jake knew them when he saw them. Eddie's were low boots with Cuban heels, maybe in this world you'd call them Magus heels, he thought, and pointed toes, what back in his other life had been known as street boppers. Kids from the mid-60s, an era Odetta Detta Susanna had just missed, might have called them beetle boots. Roland's, of course, were cowboy boots. Fancy ones you'd go dancing rather than droving in such as these, looped stitching, side decorations, narrow, haughty arches. He examined them without picking them up, then looked at his fellow travelers and frowned. They were looking at each other. You would have said three people couldn't do that, only a pair. But you only would have said it if you'd never been part of a quartet. Roland still shared Kef with them. He felt the powerful current of their mingled thought, but could not understand it. Because it's of their world. They come from different wens of that world, but they see something here that's common to all three of them. "What is it?" he asked. "What do they mean, these shoes?"
"I don't think any of us know that exactly," Susanna said.
"No," Jake said. "It's another riddle." He looked at the weird, blood-red Oxford shoe in his hands with distaste.
"Another goddamned riddle."
"Tell what you know." He looked toward the glass palace again. It was perhaps 15 New York miles away now, shining in the clear day, delicate as a mirage, but real as... well, as real as shoes. "Please tell me what you know about these shoes."
"I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children got shoes," Odetta said. "That's the prevailing opinion, anyway."
"Well," Eddie said, "we got 'em anyway. And you're thinking what I'm thinking, aren't you?"
"I guess I am.
You, Jake?"
Instead of answering with words, Jake picked up the other Oxford, Roland had no doubt that all the shoes, including Oi's, would fit perfectly, and clapped them briskly together three times. It meant nothing to Roland, but both Eddie and Susanna reacted violently, looking around, looking especially at the sky, as if expecting a storm born out of this bright autumn sunshine. They ended up looking at the glass palace again, and then at each other, in that knowing, round-eyed way that made Roland feel like shaking them both until their teeth rattled. Yet he waited. Sometimes that was all a man could do.
"After you killed Jonas, you looked into the ball," Eddie said, turning to him.
"Yes."
"Traveled in the ball."
"Yes, but I don't want to talk about that again now. It has nothing to do with these..."
"I think it does," Eddie said. "You flew inside a pink storm, inside a pink gale, you could say. Gale is a word you might use for a storm, isn't it? Especially if you were making up a riddle."
"Sure," Jake said. He sounded dreamy, almost like a boy who talks in his sleep.
"When does Dorothy fly over the wizard's rainbow? When she's a gale."
"We ain't in Kansas anymore, sugar," Susanna said, and then voiced a strange, humorless bark, which Roland supposed was a species of laughter. "May look a little like it, but Kansas was never, you know, this thin."
"I don't understand you," Roland said. But he felt cold, and his heart was beating too fast. There were thinnies everywhere now, hadn't he told them that? Worlds melting into one another as the forces of the tower weakened, as the day when the rose would be plowed under drew nearer.
"You saw things as you flew," Eddie said.
Before you got to the dark land, the one you called Thunderclap, you saw things. The piano player, Sheb, who turned up again later in your life, didn't he?
Yes, in Tull. And the dweller with the red hair? Him, too. He had a bird named Zoltan. But when we met, he and I, we said the normal life for you, life for your crop, that sort of thing. I thought I heard the same when he flew by me in the pink storm, but he really said something else. He glanced at Susanna. I saw your wheelchair, too, the old one.
And you saw the witch.
Yes. I, in a creaky chortle that reminded Roland unnervingly of Rhea, Jake Chambers cried, "I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too." Roland stared at him, trying not to gape.
"Only in the movie, the witch wasn't riding a broom," Jake said. "She was on her bike, the one with the basket on the back."
"Yeah, no reap charms either," Eddie said. "Would have been a nice touch, though. I tell you, Jake, when I was a kid, I used to have nightmares about the way she laughed."
"It was the monkeys that gave me the creeps," Susanna said. "The flying monkeys. I'd get thinking about them and then have to crawl into bed with my mom and dad. They'd still be arguing about whose bright idea was to take me to that show in the first place when I fell asleep between them."
"I wasn't worried about clapping the heels together," Jake said. "Not a bit." It was Susanna and Eddie he was speaking to. For the time being, it was as if Roland wasn't even there. "I wasn't wearing them, after all."
"True," Susanna said, sounding severe, "but you know what my daddy always used to say."
"No, but I have a feeling we're going to find out," Eddie said. She gave Eddie a brief, severe look, then turned her attention back to Jake.
"Never whistle for the wind unless you want it to blow," she said. "And it's good advice, no matter what young Mr. Foolish here may think."
"Spanked again," Eddie said, grinning.
"Spanked," Oi said, eyeing Eddie severely.
"Explain this to me," Roland said in his softest voice. "I would hear. I would share your kef. And I would share it now." 2. They told him a story almost every American child of the 20th century knew, about a Kansas farm girl named Dorothy Gale who had been carried away by a cyclone and deposited, along with her dog, in the land of Oz. There was no I-70 in Oz, but there was a yellow brick road which served much the same purpose, and there were witches, both good and bad. There was a quartet, comprised of Dorothy, Toto, and three friends she met along the way, the Cowardly Lion, the Tin Woodman, and the Scarecrow. They each had bird and bear and hare and fish a fondest wish, and it was with Dorothy's that Roland's new friends, and Roland himself, for that matter, identified the most strongly. She wanted to find her way home again. The Munchkins told her that she had to follow the yellow brick road to Oz, Jake said, and so she went. She met the others along the way, sort of like you met us, Roland.
"Although you don't look much like Judy Garland," Eddie put in.
And eventually they got there. To Oz, the Emerald Palace, and the guy who lived in the Emerald Palace. He looked toward the glass palace ahead of them, greener and greener in the strengthening light. And then back to Roland.
"Yes, I understand. And was this fellow Oz a powerful din? A baron, perhaps a king?"
Again the three of them exchanged a glance from which Roland was excluded.
"That's complicated," Jake said. "He was sort of a humbug."
"A bumhug? What's that?"
"Humbug," Jake said, laughing. "A faker. All talk, no action. But maybe the important thing is that the wizard actually came from..."
"Wizard?" Roland asked sharply. He grasped Jake's shoulder with his diminished right hand. "Why do you call him so?"
"Because that was his title, Shug," Susanna said. "The Wizard of Oz."
She lifted Roland's hand gently but firmly from Jake's shoulder.
"Let him tell it now. He don't need you to squeeze it out of him."
"Did I hurt you, Jake? I cry your pardon."
"No, I'm fine," Jake said. "Don't worry about it. Anyway, Dorothy and her friends had a lot of adventures before finding out the wizard was a, you know, a bumhug."
Jake giggled at this, with his hands clapped to his forehead and pushing back his hair like a child of 5. He couldn't give the lion courage, the scarecrow a brain, or the Tin Woodman a heart. Worst of all, he couldn't send Dorothy back to Kansas. The wizard had a balloon, but he went without her. I don't think he meant to, but he did.
"It seems to me, from your telling of the tale," Roland said, speaking very slowly, "that Dorothy's friends had the things they wanted all along."
"That's the moral of the story," Eddie said. "Maybe that's what makes it a great story. But Dorothy was stuck in Oz, you see. Then Glinda showed up, Glinda the Good. And as a present for smooshing one of the bad witches under her house and melting another one, Glinda told Dorothy how to use the ruby slippers, the ones Glinda gave her."
Eddie raised the red Cuban-heeled street boppers which had been left for him on the dotted white line of I-70. "Glinda told Dorothy to click the heels of the ruby slippers together 3 times. That would take her back to Kansas," she said. "And it did."
"And that's the end of the tale?"
"Well," Jake said, "it was so popular that the guy who wrote it went ahead and wrote about 1,000 more Oz stories."
"Yeah," Eddie said, "everything but Glinda's Guide to Firm Thighs."
"And there was this crazy remake called The Wiz, starring black people."
"Really?" Susanna asked. She looked bemused.
"What a peculiar concept." "But the only one that really matters is the first one, I think," Jake finished.
Roland hunkered and put his hands into the boots which had been left for him. He lifted them, looked at them, put them down again. "Are we supposed to put them on, do you think? Here and now?" His three friends from New York looked at each other doubtfully. At last Susanna spoke for them, fed him the kef which he could feel but not quite share on his own.
"Best not to right now, maybe. Too many badass spirits here."
"The Koro spirits," Eddie murmured, mostly to himself. Then,
"Look, let's just take them along. If we're supposed to put them on, I think we'll know when the time comes. In the meantime, I think we ought to beware of bumhogs bearing gifts."
It cracked Jake up, as Eddie had known it would. Sometimes a word or an image got into your funny bone like a virus and just lived there a while. Tomorrow the word bumhug might mean nothing to the kid. For the rest of today, however, he was going to laugh every time he heard it. Eddie intended to use it a lot, especially when old Jake wasn't expecting it. They picked up the red shoes which had been left for them in the eastbound lanes, Jake took Oi's, and moved on again toward the shimmering glass castle.
Oz, Roland thought.
He searched his memory, but he didn't think it was a name he had ever heard before, or a word of the high speech that had come in disguise, as Char had come disguised as Charlie. Yet it had a sound that belonged in this business, a sound more of his world than of Jake's, Susanna's, and Eddie's, from whence the tale had come. 3. Jake kept expecting the Green Palace to begin looking normal as they drew closer to it. The way the attractions in Disney World began to look normal as you drew close to them. Not ordinary, necessarily, but normal. Things which were as much a part of the world as the corner bus stop, or mailbox, or park bench. Stuff you could touch. Stuff you could write "Fuck Piper" on if you took a notion. But that didn't happen. Wasn't going to happen, and as they neared the Green Palace, Jake realized something else. It was the most beautiful, radiant thing he had ever seen in his life. Not trusting it, and he did not, didn't change the fact. It was like a drawing in a fairy tale book, one so good it had become real somehow. And, like the thinny, it hummed, except that this sound was far fainter, and not unpleasant. Pale green walls rose to battlements that jutted and towers that soared, seeming almost to touch the clouds floating over the Kansas plains. These towers were topped with needles of a darker emerald green. It was from these that the red pennants flickered. Upon each pennant the symbol of the open eye had been traced in yellow. "It's the mark of the Crimson King," Jake thought. "It's really his sigil, not John Farson's." He didn't know how he knew this, how could he, when Alabama's Crimson Tide was the only crimson anything he knew, but he did.
"So beautiful," Susanna murmured. And when Jake glanced at her, he thought she was almost crying. "But not nice, somehow. Not right. Maybe not downright bad, the way the thin he is, but not nice." Eddie said, "Yeah, that works. Not a red light, maybe, but a bright yellow one just the same."
He rubbed the side of his face, a gesture he had picked up from Roland without even realizing it, and looked puzzled.
"It feels almost not serious. A practical joke."
"I doubt it's a joke,"
Roland said. Do you think it's a copy of the place where Dorothy and her quartet met the false wizard? Again, the three erstwhile New Yorkers seemed to exchange a single glance of consultation. When it was over, Eddie spoke for all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. It's not the same as the one in the movie, but if this thing came out of our minds, it wouldn't be. Because we see the one from L. Frank Baum's book, too, both from the illustrations in the book and the ones from our imaginations, Jake said. But that's it, Susanna said. I'd say we're definitely off to see the wizard.
You bet, Eddie said.
Because of the wonderful things he does,
Jake and Susanna finished in unison, then laughed, delighted with each other, while Roland frowned at them, feeling puzzled and looking left out.
But I have to tell you guys, Eddie said, that it's only going to take about one more wonderful thing to send me around to the dark side of the psycho moon, most likely for good.
4. As they drew closer, they could see Interstate 70 stretching away into the pale green depths of the castle's slightly rounded outer wall. It floated there, like an optical illusion. Closer yet, and they could hear the pennants snapping in the breeze, and see their own ripply reflections, like drowned folk who somehow walk at the bottoms of watery tropical graves. There was an inner redoubt of dark blue glass. It was a color Jake associated with the bottle's fountain pen ink came in, and a rust-hued wall walk between the redoubt and the outer wall. That color made Susanna think of the bottle's Heyer's root beer had come in when she was a little girl. The way in was blocked by a barred gate that was both huge and ethereal. It looked like wrought iron which had been turned to glass. Each cunningly made stake was a different color, and these colors seemed to come from the inside, as if the bars were filled with some bright gas or liquid. The travelers stopped before it. There was no sign of the turnpike beyond it. Instead of roadway, there was a courtyard of silver glass, a huge flat mirror, in fact. Clouds floated serenely through its depths. So did the image of the occasional swooping bird. Sun reflected off this glass courtyard and ran across the green castle walls in ripples. On the far side, the wall of the palace's inner ward rose in a glimmery green cliff, broken by narrow loophole windows of jet-black glass. There was also an arched entry in this wall that made Jake think of St. Patrick's Cathedral. To the left of the main doorway was a sentry box made of cream-colored glass shot through with hazy orange threads. Its door, painted with red stripes, stood open. The phone booth-sized room inside was empty, although there was something on the floor which looked to Jake like a newspaper. Above the entry, flanking its darkness, were two crouching, leering gargoyles of darkest violet glass. Their pointed tongues poked out like bruises. The pennants atop the towers flapped like schoolyard flags. Crows cawed over empty cornfields, now a week past the reap. Distant, the thinny whined and warbled.
"Look at the bars of this gate," Susanna said. She sounded breathless and awestruck. "Look very closely."
Jake bent toward the yellow bar until his nose nearly touched it, and a faint yellow stripe ran down the middle of his face. At first he saw nothing, and then he gasped. What he had taken for motes of some kind were creatures, living creatures imprisoned inside the bar, swimming in tiny schools. They looked like fish in an aquarium, but they also... their heads, Jake told himself, I think it's mostly their heads... looked oddly, disquietingly human. As if, Jake thought, he were looking into a vertical golden sea, all the ocean in a glass rod, and living myths no bigger than grains of dust swimming within it. A tiny woman with a fish's tail and long blonde hair streaming out behind her swam to her side of the glass, seemed to peer out at the giant boy. Her eyes were round, startled, and beautiful, and then flipped away again. Jake felt suddenly dizzy and weak. He closed his eyes until the feeling of vertigo went away, then opened them again and looked around at the others.
"Cripes, are they all the same?"
"All different, I think," said Eddie, who had already peered into two or three. He bent close to the purple rod, and his cheeks lit up as if in the glow of an old-fashioned fluoroscope. These guys here look like birds, little tiny birds.
Jake looked and saw that Eddie was right. Inside the gate's purple upright were flocks of birds no bigger than summer minges. They swooped giddily about in their eternal twilight, weaving over and under one another, their wings leaving tiny silver trails of bubbles.
"Are they really there?" Jake asked breathlessly. "Are they, Roland, or are we only imagining them?"
"I don't know. But I know what this gate has been made to look like."
"So do I," Eddie said.
He surveyed the shining posts, each with its own column of imprisoned light and life. Each of the gate's wings consisted of six colored bars. The one in the center, broad and flat instead of round, and made to split in two when the gate was opened, was the 13th. This one was dead black, and in this one nothing moved.
"Oh, maybe not that you can see, but there are things moving around in there, all right," Jake thought. "There's life in there, terrible life, and maybe there are roses, too, drowned ones."
"It's a wizard's gate," Eddie said. "Each bar has been made to look like one of the balls in Merlin's rainbow. Look, here's the pink one." Jake leaned toward it, hands propped on his thighs. He knew what would be inside even before he saw them. Horses, of courses. Tiny herds of them, galloping through that strange pink stuff that was neither light nor liquid. Horses running in search of a drop they would never find, mayhap. Eddie stretched his hands out to grasp the sides of the central post, the black one.
"Don't!"
Susanna called sharply. Eddie ignored her. But Jake saw his chest stop for a moment and his lips tighten as he wrapped his hands around the black bar and waited for something. Some force perhaps sent special delivery all the way from the Dark Tower itself to change him or even to strike him dead. When nothing happened, he breathed deep again and risked a smile. "No electricity, but..." He pulled. The gate held fast. "No give, either. I see where it splits down the middle, but I get nothing. Want to take a shot, Roland?" Roland reached for the gate, but Jake put a hand on his arm and stopped him before the gunslinger could do more than give it a preliminary shake.
"Don't bother. That's not the way."
"Then what is?" Instead of answering, Jake sat down in front of the gate near the place where this strange version of I-70 ended and began putting on the shoes which had been left for him. Eddie watched a moment, then sat down beside him.
"I guess we ought to try it," he said to Jake, "even though it'll probably turn out to be just another bum hug."
Jake laughed, shook his head, and began to tighten the laces of the blood-red Oxfords. He and Eddie both knew it was no bum hug. Not this time. 5.
"Okay," Jake said when they had all put on their red shoes. He thought they looked extraordinarily stupid, especially Eddie's pair. "I'll count to three, and we'll click our heels together, like this."
He clicked the Oxfords together once, sharply, and the gate shivered like a loosely fastened shutter blown by a strong wind. Susanna cried out. There followed a low, sweet chiming sound from the Green Palace, as if the walls themselves had vibrated.
"I guess this'll do the trick, all right," Eddie said. "I warn you, though, I'm not singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. That's not in my contract."
"The rainbow is here," the gunslinger said softly, stretching his diminished hand out to the gate. It wiped the smile off Eddie's face.
"Yeah, I know. I'm a little scared, Roland."
"So am I," the gunslinger said, and indeed Jake thought he looked pale and ill.
"Go on, sugar," Susanna said. "Count before we all lose our nerve." "One, 2, 3.
They clicked their heels together solemnly and in unison. Tock, tock, tock. The gate shivered more violently this time, the colors in the uprights brightening perceptibly. The chime that followed was higher, sweeter, the sound of fine crystal tapped with the haft of a knife. It echoed in dreamy harmonics that made Jake shiver, half with pleasure and half with pain. But the gate didn't open.
What?
Eddie began. I know, Jake said. We forgot Oi.
Ah, Christ, Eddie said. I left the world I knew to watch a kid try to put booties on a fucked-up weasel. Shoot me, Roland, before I breed.
Roland ignored him, watching Jake closely as the boy sat down on the turnpike and called, Oi, to me. The bumbler came willingly enough, and although he had been a wild creature before they had met him on the path of the beam, he allowed Jake to slip the red leather booties onto his paws without making trouble. In fact, once he got the idea, he stepped into the last two. When all four of the little red shoes were in place, they looked, in fact, the most like Dorothy's ruby slippers, Oi sniffed at one of them, then looked attentively back at Jake. Jake clicked his heels together three times, looking at the bumbler as he did so, ignoring the rattle of the gate and the soft chime from the walls of the Green Palace. You, Oi!
Oi!
He rolled over on his back like a dog playing dead, then simply looked at his own feet with a kind of disgusted bewilderment. Looking at him, Jake had a sharp memory, trying to pat his stomach and rub his head at the same time, and his father making fun of him when he couldn't do it right away.
Roland, help me. He knows what he's supposed to do, but he doesn't know how to do it.
Jake glanced up at Eddie. And don't make any smart remarks, okay?
Nope, Eddie said. No smart remarks, Jake. Do you think just Oi has to do it this time, or is it still a group effort?
Just him, I think.
But it wouldn't hurt us to kind of click along with Mitch, Susanna said.
Mitch who?
Eddie asked, looking blank.
Never mind. Go on, Jake. Roland, give us a count again.
Eddie grasped Oi's forepaws. Roland gently grasped the bumbler's rear paws. Oi looked nervous at this, as if he perhaps expected to be swung briskly into the air and given the old heave-ho, but he didn't struggle.
One, two, three.
Jake and Roland gently patted Oi's forepaws and rear paws together in unison. At the same time, they clicked the heels of their own footwear. Eddie and Susanna did the same. This time the harmonic was a deep, sweet bong, like a glass church bell. The black glass bar running down the center of the gate did not split open, but shattered, spraying crumbs of obsidian glass in all directions. Some rattled against Oi's hide. He sprang up in a hurry, yanking out of Jake's and Roland's grip and trotting a little distance away. He sat on the broken white line between the travel lane and the passing lane of the highway, his ears laid back, looking at the gate and panting.
Come on, Roland said.
He went to the left wing of the gate and pushed it slowly open. He stood at the edge of the mirror courtyard, a tall, lanky man in cowpoke jeans, an ancient shirt of no particular color, and improbable red cowboy boots. Let's go in and see what the Wizard of Oz has to say for himself.
If he's still here, Eddie said.
Oh, I think he's here, Roland murmured. Yes, I think he's here.
He ambled toward the main door with the empty sentry box beside it. The others followed, welded to their own downward reflections by the red shoes like sets of Siamese twins. Oi came last, skipping nimbly along in his ruby slippers, pausing once to sniff down at his own reflected snout.
Oi!
He cried to the bumbler floating below him, and then hurried after Jake. Chapter 3 The Wizard 1 Roland stopped at the sentry box, glanced in, then picked up the thing which was lying on the floor. The others caught up with him and clustered around. It had looked like a newspaper, and that was just what it was, although an exceedingly odd one. No Topeka Capital Journal this, and no news of a population-leveling plague. The Oz Daily Buzz Volume 1568, Number 96. Daily Buzz, Handsome Is As Handsome Does. Weather, here today, gone tomorrow. Lucky numbers, none. Prognosis, bad. Blah, 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 blah. Yak, 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 blah, 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 good is bad, bad is good, all the stuff's the same.
Good is bad, bad is good, all the stuff's the same, go slow past the drawers, all the stuff's the same, blah, 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 Blaine is a pain, all the stuff's the same, yak, 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 char you tree, all the stuff's the same, blah, yak, blah, blah, yak, yak, blah, 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 yak, 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 baked turkey, cooked goose. All the stuff's the same, blah, blah, yak, yak, ride a train, die in pain, all the stuff's the same, blah, 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 blame, 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 blah, 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 yak, yak, blah, 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 blah. Related story, page 6. Below this was a picture of Roland, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake crossing the mirrored courtyard, as if this had happened the day before instead of only minutes ago. Beneath it was a caption reading, Tragedy in Oz. Travelers arrive seeking fame and fortune, find death instead. I like that, Eddie said, adjusting Roland's revolver in the holster he wore low on his hip. Comfort and encouragement after days of confusion, like a hot drink on a cold fucking night. Don't be afraid of this, Roland said. This is a joke. I'm not afraid, Eddie said. But it's a little more than a joke. I lived with Henry Dean for a lot of years, and I know when there's a plot to psych me out afoot. I know it very well. He looked curiously at Roland. I hope you don't mind me saying this, but you're the one who looks scared, Roland.
I'm terrified, Roland said simply.
2. The arched entryway made Susanna think of a song which had been popular 10 years or so before she had been yanked out of her world and into Roland's. Saw an eyeball peeping through a smoky cloud behind the green door, the lyric went. When I said Joe sent me, someone laughed out loud behind the green door. There were actually 2 doors here instead of 1, and no peephole through which an eyeball could look in either, nor did Susanna try that old speakeasy deal about how Joe had sent her. She did, however, bend forward to read the sign hanging from one of the circular glass door poles. Bell out of order, please knock, it said. Don't bother, she said to Roland, who had actually doubled up his fist to do as the sign said. It's from the story, that's all. Eddie pulled her chair back slightly, stepped in front of it, and took hold of the circular pulls. The doors opened easily, the hinges rolling in silence. He took a step forward into what looked like a shadowy green grotto, cupped his hands to his mouth, and called, Hey! The sound of his voice rolled away and came back changed, small, echoing, lost, dying, it seemed.
Christ, Eddie said. Do we have to do this?
If we want to get back to the beam, I think so. Roland looked paler than ever, but he led them in. Jake helped Eddie lift Susanna's chair over the sill, a milky block of jade-colored glass, and inside. Oi's little shoes flashed dim red on the green glass floor. They had gone only 10 paces when the doors slammed shut behind them with a no-question-about-it boom that rolled past them and went echoing away into the depths of the green palace. 3. There was no reception room, only a vaulted, cavernous hallway that seemed to go on forever. The walls were lit with a faint green glow.
This is just like the hallway in the movie, Jake thought, the one where the cowardly lion got so scared when he stepped on his own tail.
And, adding a little extra touch of verisimilitude Jake could have done without, Eddie spoke up in a trembly and better than passable Bert Lahr imitation.
Wait a minute, fellas. I was just thinking. I really don't want to see the wizard this much. I better wait for you outside.
Stop it! Jake said sharply. Up it, Oi agreed.
He walked directly at Jake's heels, swinging his head watchfully from side to side as he went. Jake could hear no sound except for their own passage. Yet he sensed something. A sound that wasn't. It was, he thought, like looking at a wind chime that wants only the slightest puff of breeze to set it tinkling.
Sorry, Eddie said. Really?
He pointed. Look down there. About 40 yards ahead of them, the green corridor did end, in a narrow green doorway of amazing height, perhaps 30 feet from the floor to its pointed tip. And from behind it, Jake could now hear a steady thrumming sound.
As they drew closer and the sound grew louder, his dread grew. He had to make a conscious effort to take the last dozen steps to the door. He knew this sound. He knew it from the run he'd made with Gasher under Lud, and from the run he and his friends had made on Blaine the Mono. It was the steady beat, beat, beat of slow trans engines.
"It's like a nightmare," he said in a small, close-to-tears voice. "We're right back where we started."
"No, Jake," the gunslinger said, touching his hair. "Never think it. What you feel is an illusion. Stand and be true." The sign on this door wasn't from the movie, and only Susanna knew it was from Dante. "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here," it said. Roland reached out with his two-fingered right hand and pulled the 30-foot door open. 4. What lay beyond it was, to the eyes of Jake, Susanna, and Eddie, a weird combination of the Wizard of Oz and Blaine the Mono. A thick rug, pale blue like the one in the Barony coach, lay on the floor. The chamber was like the nave of a cathedral, soaring to impenetrable heights of greenish-black. The pillars which supported the glowing walls were great glass ribs of alternating green and pink light. The pink was the exact shade of Blaine's hull. Jake saw these supporting pillars had been carven with a billion different images, none of them comforting. They jostled the eye and unsettled the heart. There seemed to be a preponderance of screaming faces. Ahead of them, dwarfing the visitors, turning them into creatures that seemed no bigger than ants, was the chamber's only furnishing, an enormous green glass throne. Jake tried to estimate its size and was unable. He had no reference points to help him. He thought that the throne's back might be 50 feet high, but it could as easily have been 75 or 100. It was marked with the open-eye symbol, this time traced in red instead of yellow. The rhythmic thrusting of the light made the eye seem alive, to be beating like a heart. Above the throne, rising like the pipes of a mighty medieval organ, were 13 great cylinders, each pulsing a different color. Each, that was, save for the pipe which ran directly down in back of the throne's center. That one was black as midnight and as still as death. "Hey!" Susanna shouted from her chair. "Anyone here?" At the sound of her voice, the pipes flashed so brilliantly that Jake had to shield his eyes. For a moment, the entire throne room glared like an exploding rainbow. Then the pipes went out, went dark, went dead, just as the wizard's glass in Roland's story had done when the glass, or the force inhabiting the glass, decided to shut up for a while. Now there was only the column of blackness and the steady green pulse of the empty throne. Next, a somehow tired humming sound, as of a very old servo mechanism being called into use one final time, began to whine its way into their ears. Panels, each at least 6 feet long and 2 feet wide, slid open in the arms of the throne. From the black slots thus revealed, a rose-colored smoke began to drift out and up. As it rose, it darkened to a bright red, and in it a terribly familiar zigzag line appeared. Jake knew what it was even before the words Lud, Candleton, Rylea, the Falls of the Hounds, Dasherville, Topeka appeared, glowing smoke bright. It was Blaine's route map. Roland could say all he wanted about how things had changed, how Jake's feeling of being trapped in a nightmare, "This is the worst nightmare of my life, and that is the truth," was just an illusion created by his confused mind and frightened heart. But Jake knew better. This place might look a little bit like the throne room of Oz the Great and Terrible, but it was really Blaine the Mono. They were back aboard Blaine, and soon the riddling would begin all over again. Jake felt like screaming. 5. Eddie recognized the voice that boomed out of the smoky route map hanging above the green throne, but he believed it was Blaine the Mono no more than he believed it was the Wizard of Oz. Some wizard, perhaps, but this wasn't the Emerald City, and Blaine was just as dead as dog shit. Eddie had sent him home with a fucking rupture.
"Hello there again, little trail hands,"
the smoky route map pulsed, but Eddie no longer associated it with the voice, although he guessed they were supposed to. No, the voice was coming from the pipes. He glanced down, saw Jake's paper-white face, and knelt beside him.
"It's crap, kid," he said.
"No, it's Blaine, not dead."
"He's dead, all right. This is nothing but an amplified version of the after-school announcements. Who's got detention and who's supposed to report to Room 6 for speech therapy, you dig?"
"What?"
Jake looked up at him, lips wet and trembling, eyes dazed.
What do you...
"Those pipes are speakers. Even a pipsqueak can sound big through a 12-speaker Dolby sound system. Don't you remember the movie? It has to sound big because it's a bum hug, Jake. Just a bum hug."
"What are you telling him, Eddie of New York? One of your stupid, nasty-minded little jokes? One of your unfair riddles?"
"Yeah," Eddie said. "The one that goes, how many dipolar computers does it take to screw in a light bulb? Who are you, buddy? I know goddamn well you're not playing the mono, so who are you?"
"I am Oz," the voice thundered.
The glass columns flashed, so did the pipes behind the throne.
"Oz the Great, Oz the Powerful, who are you?"
Susanna rolled forward until her wheelchair was at the base of the dull green steps leading up to a throne that would have dwarfed even Lord Perth.
"I'm Susanna Dean, the small and crippled," she said, "and I was raised to be polite, but not to suffer bullshit. We're here because we're supposed to be here. Why else did we get left the shoes?"
"What do you want of me, Susanna?"
"What would you have, little cowgirl?"
"You know," she said. "We want what everyone wants, so far as I know, to go back home again, 'cause there's no place like home."
You can't go home," Jake said. He spoke in a rapid, frightened murmur. "You can't go home again. Thomas Wolfe said that, and that is the truth."
"It's a lie, Shug," Susanna said. "A flat-out lie. You can go home again. All you have to do is find the right rainbow and walk under it. We found it. The rest is just, you know, footwork."
"Would you go back to New York, Susanna Dean, Eddie Dean, Jake Chambers?"
"Is that what you ask of Oz, the mighty and powerful?"
"New York isn't home for us anymore," Susanna said.
She looked very small, yet very fearless, as she sat in her new wheelchair at the foot of the enormous, pulsing throne.
"No more than Gilead is home for Roland. Take us back to the path of the beam. That's where we want to go, because that's our way home, only way home we got."
"Go away," cried the voice from the pipes. "Go away and come back tomorrow. We'll discuss the beam then. Fiddle-dee-dee," said Scarlet, "we'll talk about the beam tomorrow, for tomorrow is another day."
"No," Eddie said, "we'll talk about it now."
"Do not arouse the wrath of the great and powerful Oz," the voice cried,
and the pipes flashed furiously with each word. Susanna was sure this was supposed to be scary, but she found it almost amusing instead. It was like watching a salesman demonstrate a child's toy. "Hey, kids, when you talk, the pipes flash bright colors. Try it and see."
"Sugar, you best listen now," Susanna said. "What you don't want is to arouse the wrath of folks with guns, especially when you be living in a glass house."
"I said come back tomorrow."
Red smoke once more began to boil out of the slots in the arms of the throne. It was thicker now. The shape which had been Blaine's route map melted apart and joined it. The smoke formed a face this time. It was narrow and hard and watchful, framed by long hair.
"It's the man Roland shot in the desert," Susanna thought wonderingly. "It's that man Jonas. I know it is."
Now Oz spoke in a slightly trembling voice.
"Do you presume to threaten the great Oz?"
The lips of the huge, smoky face hovering over the throne seat parted in a snarl of mingled menace and contempt.
"You ungrateful creatures! Oh, you ungrateful creatures!"
Eddie, who knew smoke and mirrors when he saw them, had glanced in another direction. His eyes widened, and he gripped Susanna's arm above the elbow.
"Look," he whispered. "Christ, Sus, look at Oi!"
The Billy Bumbler had no interest in smoke ghosts, whether they were monorail route maps, dead coffin hunters, or just Hollywood special effects of the pre-World War II variety. He had seen or smelled something that was more interesting. Susanna grabbed Jake, turned him, and pointed at the Bumbler. She saw the boy's eyes widen with understanding a moment before Oi reached the small alcove in the left wall. It was screened from the main chamber by a green curtain which matched the glass walls. Oi stretched his long neck forward, caught the curtain's fabric in his teeth, and yanked it back. 6. Behind the curtain, red and green lights flashed. Cylinders spun inside glass boxes, needles moved back and forth inside long rows of lighted dials. Yet Jake barely noticed these things. It was the man who took all his attention, the one sitting at the console, his back to them. His filthy hair, streaked with dirt and blood, hung to his shoulders in matted clumps. He was wearing some sort of headset and was speaking into a tiny mic which hung in front of his mouth. His back was to them, and at first he had no idea that Oi had smelled him out and uncovered his hiding place.
"Go!" thundered the voice from the pipes. Except now Jake saw where it was really coming from. "Come back tomorrow if you like, but go now, I warn you."
"It is Jonas. Roland must not have killed him after all," Eddie whispered, but Jake knew better. He had recognized the voice. Even distorted by the amplification of the colored pipes, he had recognized the voice. How could he have ever believed it to be the voice of Blaine?
"I warn you, if you refuse,"
Oi barked, a sharp and somehow forbidding sound. The man in the equipment alcove began to turn.
"Tell me, Cully,"